You're listening to The Philosopher's Note on 10 to 25. More wisdom in less time.
Hi, this is Brian. Welcome to The Philosopher's Notes on 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People by David Yeager, PhD. As always, let's kick it off with a quote. It seems like everywhere you turn, you hear older adults, Gen Xers, millennials, and boomers describing young people today in dark and despairing terms. In my 18 years as a developmental scientist and 13 years as a parent, I've heard it in the bleachers at my kids' games, in the boardrooms of major corporations I've consulted for, and by the water coolers at schools I've visited. They just don't care. They speak a different language. They're entitled. They're too sensitive. But imagine a world in which older adults interact with young people aged 10 to 25 in ways that reliably leave the next generation feeling inspired, enthusiastic, and ready to contribute, rather than disengaged, outraged, worried, or overwhelmed. In this world, managers' work will be easier because their younger employees will be motivated and self-sufficient. Parents will be happier because they won't have to dread their children turning into teenagers. Educators will feel more successful and less burned out because they can reach a stressed out or disengaged generation of young people. And all the rest of us will be able to bridge the divide between the generations with confidence without starting a war of words. I've seen this world in the lives of great managers, parents, educators, and coaches. I've studied what they do and how they talk. I've used the scientific method, hypothesis, experiment, data, results, to understand why they're effective. I wrote this book because I want to share the secrets I've learned. This book is for anyone who wants to experience this better world firsthand in their interactions with young people aged 10 to 25. It shows how to stop clashing with the next generation and start inspiring them. End quote. That is David Yeager, PhD, from 10 to 25. Now, I got this book after one of our big heroic investors, who also happens to be an elite performance coach for world-class athletes and the next generation of elite athletes, sent me a text telling me it was incredible. Thanks, Chase. I immediately got it. It was waiting for me when I got back from a Just the Boys weekend chess tournament with Emerson. I immediately started reading it, as I knew it would be a great resource for all the parents and grandparents and teachers and coaches and CEOs we're blessed to serve as we strive to raise the next generation of heroes. It's fantastic. We got a link to get a copy in the note. Now, I've often said that my two favorite parenting books are Carol Dweck's Mindset and Self-Theories. She says this about this book. This book will change millions of lives. Whether you're a teacher, parent, or manager, it's hard to understand young people, what they want, what will help them flourish, and what will make your life with them rewarding. Superstar researcher David Yeager provides answers that have been validated by both scientific studies and real-world experts. This is one of the most fascinating and important books of the past decade. David worked with Carol Dweck. He is one of her protégés. She sums it up brilliantly. And as per the back flap of the book, David Yeager, PhD, is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and a co-founder of the Texas Behavioral Science and Policy Institute. His research has been featured everywhere from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal to Scientific American, CNN, Fox News, and The Atlantic. Yeager is the only developmental scientist to have won all three of the major awards for early career contributions to developmental psychology, and the only one to have won best paper awards in four different fields: behavioral science, social psychology, developmental psychology, and education. He got his PhD and MA at Stanford University and his BA and MED at the University of Notre Dame. Go Fighting Irish. In other words, he's one of the most respected developmental and social psychologists in the world, and this book is packed with big ideas, and we're barely going to scratch the surface of its wisdom, so let's get straight to work. First big idea, the mentor's dilemma and wise feedback. Quote, in 2014, I published a scientific experiment with Jeffrey Cohen and others on a simple but effective solution to the mentor's dilemma. We called it wise feedback. We had instructors be critical with their feedback, but accompany that criticism with a clear and transparent statement about the reason they were giving that feedback. Namely, that they believed the student could meet a high standard if they got the right support. So-called wise feedback is wise or attuned to the predicament of young people who don't want to be held to an impossible standard and who also don't want to be talked down to. We tested wise feedback in an experiment with middle school students in social studies classrooms. The seventh grade students wrote first drafts of five paragraph essays about their personal heroes. Next, teachers covered the essays with critical comments and suggestions. You need to put a comma here, explain this idea further, rearrange that sentence. Before the students got the essays, though, the research team attached handwritten notes from the teachers, either a treatment note or a control note. Teachers wrote the notes, but they didn't know which student got which note or what the study was trying to test. Half the students, randomly assigned, got the treatment note with the wise feedback, which said, I'm giving you these comments because I have very high standards and I know that you can reach them. The other half of the students got a vague control group note, I'm giving you these comments so that you'll have feedback on your essay. That note conveyed no clear reason for the feedback. We were hoping that the wise feedback would motivate students in the treatment group to work harder on their revisions. But even we were surprised by how strongly they responded. When students received the wise feedback note, they were twice as likely to revise their essays. 40% of the students in the control group revised their essays, but 80% did in the treatment group. End quote. And that's from page 5 of the introduction. It captures the thesis and practical wisdom of the book. Right before that study, David tells us about what he describes as the mentor's dilemma. He tells us that, and I quote, it's very hard to simultaneously criticize someone's work and motivate them because criticism can crush a young person's confidence. It's a dilemma because leaders feel like they're stuck between two bad choices. They could either put up with poor performance but be nice, or demand high performance but be cruel. Neither option is ideal. All too often, both sides, younger and older, tend to leave these interactions frustrated or offended, even though both sides might have entered the interaction with growth in mind. So, back to the wise feedback study. To quickly recap, randomly assign middle schoolers into two groups. Have them write a first draft of a five-paragraph essay on one of their heroes. Awesome. Then give them feedback on their essay. Half of them get a note that says, I'm giving you these comments because I have very high standards and I know that you can reach them. While the other half gets a note saying, I'm giving you these comments so that you'll have feedback on your essay. What happens? Twice as many kids in the wise feedback group work hard to get better. As David says, quote, here's the takeaway. When you hold young people to high standards and make it clear that you believe they can meet these standards, you are respecting them because you're taking them seriously. Young people rise to meet the challenge because being respected is motivating. Further, you lift up all students and see greater equity, end quote. P.S. Another big fan of the book is Angela Duckworth in Grit. She tells us about wise parenting. Same basic idea. The short story? Wise parents are both warm and demanding. They have high standards and they give support. On the other hand, what she calls authoritarian parents have high standards but low warmth. Permissive parents have high warmth but low standards. Neglectful have neither. Next big idea, the mentor mindset. Quote, through years of observing and interviewing these leaders, I discovered what distinguished them from their less successful colleagues, their mentor mindsets. This mindset is consistent with the lesson of the wise feedback note, of course, but it also is more profound and nuanced. I called it a mindset because it was a worldview and suite of behaviors. It went beyond simple statements and included concrete actions. What's more, these mentor mindset leaders were far more effective than peers who used enforcer or protector mindsets. The simplest way to understand these mindsets, enforcer, protector, and mentor, is to examine the framework presented in Figure 2.1. The first thing to notice is that there isn't just one axis, rigor, that organizes leaders' approaches with young people. It's not the case that we can only be low-rigor pushovers, i.e. the protector, or high-rigor dictators, i.e. the enforcer. In fact, there are two axes. You can have high standards and high support. You can be a mentor. Think of two perpendicular dimensions. One is standards, i.e. rigor or expectations, and the other is support, social, emotional, or material. High standards, low support, that's the enforcer mindset. High support, low standards, that's the protector mindset. High standards, high support, that's the mentor mindset. There's a fourth quadrant in the bottom left, the apathetic mindset. These checked out people tend to end up in either the enforcer or protector quadrants when they re-engage anyway, so there isn't much use in describing them. End quote. Now, after David walks us through what we get wrong about our relationships with the younger generation in chapter number one, in chapter number two, he walks us through how to get it right. While the wise feedback is a great standalone idea, the mentor mindset is a great lifetime leadership practice. To recap, when we have high standards but low support, we are in the enforcer mindset. When we have low standards and high support, we're in the protector mindset. When we have both high standards and high support, we are in the mentor mindset. That's where we want to play. As David tells us, enforcers can build on their high standards by adding more support. Protectors can build on their care and concern by adding high standards. Both are half right, and so both just need to add one element to get it all the way right. Now, here are some quick ideas on how to go about doing just that. Next big idea, transparency. Quote, you've got a mentor mindset. You maintain high standards, you're supportive. But do the young people in your life know it? If they don't understand how your leadership can help unlock their potential, then your actions won't motivate them nearly as much as they could. Transparency about mentor mindset actions makes a difference, and anyone can start being transparent right away. You simply explain what you're doing and why, end quote. That's from the first chapter in section two, which is all about mentor mindset practices. After we get the theory on the power of the mentor mindset, it's time to move to practice. David gives us five core practices, each of which gets its own chapter. Number one, transparency. Number two, questioning. Number three, stress. Number four, purpose. Number five, belonging. Let's look at each quickly. Number one, transparency. You need to explicitly tell the kids you parent slash young adults you lead what your intentions are. For example, I'm really committed to helping you activate your potential, which I think is extraordinary. To crush it together, I'm going to hold you to high standards of excellence, and I'm going to help you hit those standards. Let's go. Number two, questioning. Tell less and ask more. David says, and I quote, asking questions, particularly ones that launch us into joint problem-solving, collaborative troubleshooting mode, can show young people that we need to work together to understand the mismatch of priorities. Number three, stress. We're going to focus on this in the next idea, time to eat stress, like an energy bar. Number four, purpose. David worked with William Damon and Carol Dweck at Stanford, lucky guy, helping the 10 to 25-year-olds we lead make the connection between what they're doing now and why they're doing it, both for their own benefit and for something bigger than themselves, is super important. And number five, belonging. David walks us through the new science of belonging. It's powerful. He also walks us through the science of bullying. It's fascinating. For now, know this, I quote, we secure our sense of belonging through experiences of looking competent in front of the people whose opinions we care about, earned prestige. We need to help our 10 to 25s create this earned prestige via high standards and high support, as wise mentors. That's a really big idea. Now, let's talk about stress. Next big idea, stress. What are your beliefs? Quote, contemporary Western culture has tended to give people problematic beliefs about stress. Stanford University psychologist Dr. Aaliyah Crum, a key architect of the scientific revolution in the study of stress, calls it the stress is debilitating belief. This is the belief that stress inevitably harms our performance and health. That belief, in turn, leads to the conclusion that we should avoid stress whenever possible. Often, the stress is debilitating belief leads us to a protector mindset. If someone we care about is experiencing stress and we believe stress is bad, then it makes sense to encourage them to take action to reduce their stress, e.g. scaling back ambitions. Or we intervene to protect them from stress, e.g. taking away their responsibilities. Other times, the stress is debilitating belief can make us enforcers. We say or think something like, I know that what we're doing is very stressful, but you need to be gritty and power through it or give up because I can't do anything to help you. Stress is either a bad thing to avoid or a bad thing that one must suffer through alone. Crum's work has shown that our culture's stress is debilitating belief is both untrue and unhelpful. It's untrue because stress is often the natural byproduct of us choosing to do something that is hard, but that's important to us. The stress is debilitating belief is unhelpful because when we believe that stress is debilitating and then we notice our stress, we feel even more worried. We may think, what is wrong with me that I am the kind of person who gets stressed? We stress about being stressed. What ideas can replace our culture's stress is debilitating belief? Crum has proposed an stress can be enhancing belief. With this belief, stress can serve as a source of energy to fuel improved performance. With that belief, you can encourage people to lean into their stress, to use it as an asset. You're not lowering standards. You're just helping them see how their body's stress can act as a resource to help them meet the higher standard. When we teach a stress can be enhancing belief, it can convince young people to see some forms of stress as a positive resource. What's more, when we emphasize that stress can be enhancing and it actually helps them do well, then they remember it. This mentor mindset approach to stress, embracing stress rather than running from it or getting crushed by it, helps impart a nugget of wisdom that reinforces resilience in the long run. End quote. Stress, viewed properly, it does a hero good. Unfortunately, as David tells us, too many of us these days have what Dr. Aaliyah Crum calls a stress is debilitating view of stress. When we hold that perspective, we literally change our underlying biology for the worse. Our cortisol goes up while our testosterone goes down. We want to master this wisdom so we can help the young people we mentor adopt a stress can be enhancing mindset. We need to help them see that we can use stress as fuel for our growth. Now, the book is packed with goodness, but this is my favorite chapter. We talk about parallel wisdom in our notes on Kelly McGonigal's The Upside of Stress, which is basically a book-length overview of the same research. Check out those notes for more. For now, I want to share a couple of blurbs David used in one of the studies he shares that helped people transform their mindset around stress. He focused on two different messages. First, growth mindset messaging, and then second, stress can be enhancing messaging. We'll start with the growth mindset messaging. He told the participants in the study, quote, when you're faced with difficult challenges and you keep trying until you get better, your brain grows new connections and becomes better at taking on new challenges in the future. When something does feel really difficult, your brain learns how to respond more effectively to that challenge. It's a lot like the way rigorous exercise makes your muscles really sore at first, but with training, your muscles don't just get stronger, they also recover more quickly when you push them to their limit. Then here's the stress can be enhancing messaging. I quote again, people often mistake their body's stress response for a sign that they're in a situation they can't handle. It's easy to do racing heart, fast breathing, sweating. These are also ways our bodies respond in emergencies when we're in real trouble. This is a mistake that actually can cause you to perform worse, because if you think your stress response is a problem, you're more likely to be worried about it and get distracted from performing. You can use your body's stress response effectively next time you feel it kicking in while you're trying to perform or master something difficult. When you start to feel anxious, try to remind yourself that this is your body's way of helping you rise and meet the challenge you're facing. That should help you to spend less time worrying about the fact that you feel anxious. Then you can focus on what you're doing and let your body's stress response give you the extra boost you need, end quote. Of course, we talk about this all the time, and I love the way David frames that. Next and final big idea, a micro moment of life-changing encouragement. Quote, Dr. Daniel Lapsley is a professor of adolescent psychology at the University of Notre Dame. He grew up in Pittsburgh, where his father was a coal miner while his mother was a homemaker. He never thought about college because nobody in his family had ever been. One summer day in 1965, just before he started seventh grade, Lapsley and his friends were hanging out at a gas station after playing basketball. Lapsley struck up a conversation with a college-aged guy who was waiting for his car to get fixed. Soon the topic turned to the Vietnam War. Lapsley was a reader, and he precociously defended President Johnson's domino theory of communism in the region and the United States' role in the war. The college guy argued the other side in earnest, a little surprised that Lapsley had done his research, but also encouraging him. He gave no hint of ridicule, sarcasm, or belittlement. When his car was ready, he turned to Lapsley and said, "You are an extraordinarily bright kid. Have you thought about going to college?" Then, for reasons Lapsley still didn't understand, he asked if Lapsley had read Dante's The Divine Comedy and said how much he would enjoy it, implying that Lapsley would be up for the challenging read. Lapsley was 12. He can still remember the exhilarating pride, the earned prestige. "I walked home as if striding mountains. Imagine this stranger urging me to go to college, wondering if I've read Dante." This interaction offers a good example of what I mean when I say that earned prestige is motivating. Eventually, Lapsley did indeed go to college, just like the stranger had recommended, and he never left. He earned his PhD and spent his entire adult life as a college professor. He now serves as a lead mentor in the university's program to support first-generation college students, end quote. Now, that's from a chapter in Section 3, which is all about building a better future. The chapter that precedes it is an incredibly inspiring look at how we create inclusive excellence, such that disadvantaged groups are best given the opportunity to do truly excellent work and flourish while making important contributions to their fields and communities. The main theme of that chapter and how we create inclusive excellence, the essence of the entire book, the mentor mindset featuring its hallmark of high standards and high support. Now, right after that passage above, Yeager tells us that Lapsley said that, and I quote again, "The encounter with the stranger at the gas station looms larger than any teacher, larger than anything that happened in any school. The stranger at the gas station planted an idea, raised a possibility that had not occurred to me. He made me feel special, talented. This clear, vivid memory I have has never shaken. And I credit this encounter, this stranger, with setting me on the path that was unusual for kids in the steel town of my birth." Now, I actually got emotional reading his story, and I did reading it right now, too, as I felt into my own upbringing and an experience I had just last weekend. Now, I nearly wept recounting the story with Alexandra a moment ago before I typed this. I talk about it in a plus one called The Gas Station Chat. I didn't have space to talk about it in this note, 6 pages long, whether I got more to share or not. I got a constraint there. But the short story is I met a kid at Emerson's tournament while I was waiting for him to finish his final round. And this kid came out 4 hours into the final round, right? And he came up to the score sheet and he put up his victory. And I happened to be standing next to him. And I looked at him and I said, "Man, great job, you won." I get emotional right now, you know, and you can tell this kid didn't come from necessarily the best background. And he said, I just love chess. I play it as much as I can, you know, when I'm not working or I'm not going to school. And it was one of those sweet moments where I tried to do what that guy at the gas station did for Lapsley and just supporting him and give him what David Yeager calls earned prestige, where you want to feel the respect. You want to feel the status that you're important. And it was a really, really special moment. As you can tell, as I continue to get emotional, but check out the plus one. It's linked in this note called the Gas Station Chat. For now, here's to doing the hard work to forge the strength for two so we can be the wise mentors the next generation needs. It's time to change the world, and there's no way we'll do it without you and your 10 to 25 year olds leading the way. With love and arete, I say, let's go, hero. That is a quick look at this great book, 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People. If you experience or you interact with kids, young people, 10 to 25 years old, I highly, highly, highly recommend the book. It's not an easy read. It's a dense, packed with wisdom, but super practical look at how to motivate the next generation. I can't think of anything that's more important than that. Of course, tied for first is you showing up as your best self, who you are. Will always speak more loudly than anything you do or that you say. But this book is now my go-to resource for parenting. As I've said, Carol Dweck's two books, Mindset, Self Theories, check those out, have always been my top parenting books. This guy was her number one protege. This is an extension of her philosophy. Once again, it's fantastic. Check it out. For now, we will enjoy some quotes from the sidebar and then send you on your way. David Yeager, PhD, tells us, our society tends to think that there are only two ways to interact with young people, tough or soft, mean or nice, authoritarian or permissive. We don't realize that you can have a bit of both. You can have high standards and high support. Status and respect are to a young person what food and sleep are to a baby, core needs that, when satisfied, can unlock better motivation and behavior. I didn't talk about it a lot in the note, but this is a really, really big idea. Status and respect. Status and respect are to a young person what food and sleep are to a baby, core needs that, when satisfied, can unlock better motivation and behavior. So we need to help our kids and those young people in our lives achieve the status and respect that they aspire to and that they need to experience neurobiologically. When we succeed at doing that, they will listen to us. They will follow us. If we fail at helping them do that, they will go to their peer group and do what they need to do rebelliously to get the status and respect. This really helped make explicit a lot of the work that Alexander and I have been doing with Emerson, who's now almost 12, and that we obviously are doing with Eleanor as well, who is 7.5. Remember, helping your young kids, grandkids, etc., earn status and respect in meaningful ways, earn prestige, is a huge part of our role that we need to play with that next generation. Back to David, he tells us, the Maori tribe in New Zealand has a beautiful term for it, whaka mana. It's spelled W-H-A-K-A-M-A-N-A and pronounced whaka mana, which means to give prestige to give authority to, confirm, enable, authorize, legitimize, empower, validate. Mana means power, and whaka means to give. Whaka mana is what leaders need to do to resolve the adolescent predicament and satisfy young people's sensitivity to status and respect. Once again, the need for status and respect is as real as the need for food and sleep for a baby. It is neurobiologically wired for 10 to 25-year-olds. And we've got to get really good at helping them get it in effective ways, or they will go about trying to get it in ineffective ways. Back to David. By giving young people the thrilling opportunity to earn prestige and satisfy their needs for status and respect, mentor mindset leaders offer them the chance to feel amazing. Young people soon learn that if they want to keep feeling that way and avoid feeling humiliated, they should follow the mentor mindset leader. The enforcer or protector mindset leaders, by shaming, blaming, judging, evaluating, and controlling young people, deny the opportunity to earn prestige. That's demotivating. The result is what Rosalie Wax saw on the reservation. Passive or active teen rebellion. Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning, written in 1946, says, "A person who becomes conscious of the responsibility they bear toward a human being who affectionately waits for them or to an unfinished work knows the why for their existence and will be able to bear almost any how." In other words, make the connection between what you're doing and who you are serving. David tells us that Dodson called this solution a transparency statement, a simple and clear declaration of your intentions at the start of any potentially threatening interaction. And again, transparency is the first of five practices we talked about. Transparency, questioning, stress, purpose, and belonging. State explicitly, don't assume that they know that you really, really love them. You hold them to high standards because you care. And equally, you are committed to doing everything in your power to help them hit those standards. I have said that to Emerson and Eleanor so many times. My number one job in life, I tell them, is to help them get what they want in life. I will do everything I possibly can to help them in that regard. They feel it because I mean it. Then, of course, we got to follow it up and avoid falling into the enforcer and the protector mindsets and be that wise mentor for the 10 to 25s. Socrates, in Plato's Meno, once said, "I shall only ask him and not teach him, and he shall share the inquiry with me." This idea of questioning, listening more, asking questions, collaborating together, another big practice Alexander and I have with the kids. We don't want to tell them what to do. We want to help them make the connection between the things they do and whether or not they're getting the things that they want. Then it's an intrinsic sense of wisdom that they have, not something forced upon them. David tells us the mentor mindset transformed the lives of all young people, and especially those who were marginalized by their race, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status. He tells us if young people's brains seek social reward, status, respect, prestige, and hope to avoid social failures, shame, humiliation, rejection, then we can turn these motivations into assets, not liabilities for healthy development. When we mentor for future growth, it's far better to give young people experiences that show them they are capable of meeting the high standard with the appropriate support, rather than offering them unfounded assurances of their abilities, or worse, hiding the standards from them altogether. And finally, Kurt Hahn tells us, "We are all better than we know. If only we can be brought to realize this, we may never again be prepared to settle for anything else." We are all better than we know. If only we can be brought to realize this, we may never again be prepared to settle for anything else. That is a quick look at this great book, 10 to 25, The Science of Motivating Young People. I hope you feel from me the fact that I love you, I care about you, I believe in your potential. These high standards we're always coming back to, closing the gap between who we're capable of being, who we're actually being moment to moment to moment. Those high standards combined with what I hope you feel to be a high level of support from me, from our team, and I hope you feel just how committed we are to doing everything we possibly can to serve you, to serve your family and your communities. It is day one. We are all in. Let's go.
We hope you enjoyed that philosopher's note. Go to heroic.us to download more.